Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network, and occasionally we like to tell our listeners about podcasts we really like, and a podcast we really like is called The Endless Knot. It's hosted by Avan McMaster and Mark Sundaram. Mark is a medievalist, and Avan is a classicist, and on their podcast, they talk about all manner of things, medieval and classical, and occasionally other intellectual topics, which I think you'll find very interesting, and they're really entertaining hosts, let me say that. You can find The Endless Knot on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, and other places where you find podcasts, or you can just go directly to their website, which is alliterative.net. That's alliterative.net, and you can download episodes there. The episode you're about to listen to is from The Endless Knot, and I hope you find it entertaining. Thanks very much.
Welcome to The Endless Knot Podcast,
where the more we know,
the more we want to find out,
tracing serendipitous connections through our lives
and across disciplines.
Hi, I'm Avan.
And I'm Mark.
And today, we're talking about Rome. First, one brief but very important thank you to our newest patrons on Patreon, Alexander Mulberg and Sean Greening. Thank you so much for your support. We really, really appreciate it. And if anyone else would like to join them, you can go to patreon.com/theendlessknot. Now, today, we're very happy to bring you an interview with award-winning podcaster and now New York Times best-selling author Mike Duncan.
Mike started his podcast, The History of Rome, 10 years ago, has since moved on to his Revolutions podcast, and joined us to talk about his new book, The Storm Before the Storm, The Beginning of the End of the Roman Republic, which is now out and available in both hardcover and audiobook formats.
Welcome, Mike. We're so pleased to have you here with us to talk about, well, most importantly, your book, and then some other stuff.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Of course, we want to talk about the book, but we can talk about other things too, for sure.
But I thought we might as well start with, tell us about your book and when it's out and what it's about and why everybody should, if they have not already, as they were supposed to, pre-ordered it, why they should do so now.
So the book is called The Storm Before the Storm, The Beginning of the End of the Roman Republic. It comes out on October the 24th, 2017, which as we record this is just about a week from now. But whenever you happen to be listening to it out there in the world, people, maybe it's already out. Maybe it's about to be out. And it is a book that explores, obviously, it's right there in the subtitle, the beginning of the end of the Roman Republic, because we all know the story of the end of the Republic. We all know about Julius Caesar. We all know about Antony and Cleopatra and Pompey. And that sort of that last generation that destroyed the Republic, their story is told and told and told over and over again. But for whatever reason, the story of how the Republic started to collapse in the first place has been very, I think, undercovered, especially in popular literature. So this book is hopefully going to shed light on what is a very critical period in the late Republic and in Roman history. And you should buy it because, you know, I have got kids to feed. I've got a mortgage now. So those are the real brass tacks reasons why you should buy the book. But I think, you know, it's a great narrative history of, you know, about 50 or 60 years of Roman history.
I agree with you absolutely that it's a fascinating period, mm-hmm. and one, as you say, that just isn't talked about as much because it doesn't have Julius Caesar and it doesn't have emperors. I mean, I think that's a simplistic reason, but I think that's a lot of it.
Yeah, and it's weird, at least to me, like I'm not complaining about it because it had always been like this golden opportunity, like this really like this uncovered, like really rich and fertile territory that like nobody had homesteaded yet or whatever. And it's just like, oh, that's going to be great if I ever have the chance to, because like the Gracchi and Marius and Sulla and these guys, like they're just as like giant and interesting. And the times that they lived in were just as exciting as anything that Caesar was up to. I mean, mm-hmm. Sulla, I mean, you can't really say like, oh, the life of Caesar was really interesting and exciting. The life of Sulla was, oh, geez, what a boring drag. Like, no, that's not at all the case. So yeah. I always knew that those guys were going to be sitting there. And I'd always, you know, kind of, I had this idea in my back pocket for a while. And I'm really glad nobody else made the really obvious decision to write about this period.
This is good. You kind of preempted my question that I wanted to ask, is, you know, why this period? But I wonder, were you considering other periods? Were you sort of weighing a few options, or was this just the one that you wanted to do?
For the time, like when I was first approached about, you know, whether or not I would like to write a book, the answer is yes. and what period I would like to cover, I think I had really settled on this period as this was like my A pitch, right? This was like my first pitch. But in general, like in sort of the broad scope of Roman history, like at some point I have always wanted to do something on the Samnite Wars, like that period in Roman history, which is, you know, when Rome moves from being just like local city state to masters of Italy. That is also one of those periods that is so important to the development of like all of Roman civilization. But again, like nobody ever talks about the Samnite Wars. Even if you go back to like the Middle Republic era, it's, you know, it's all the focus is going to be on, I mean, not, you know, unjustifiably, on the Punic Wars and on Hannibal. Yeah. But you go back 100 years earlier and the Samnite Wars are really important. And then also at some point, if this book is a hit, this is the other reason you need to buy the book, is if this book is a success, then they'll let me write more books in the future. And I would definitely like to tackle the crisis of the 3rd century and everything that happened in that maelstrom in the 200s.
Yeah, the Samnite Wars, the big issue there, I guess, is sources. There's so much more complicated, or there's a lot of missing stuff for that period.
Right.
That's different, you know, that's different than what you're covering in this book. You've got some decent, not perfect sources, but some decent sources for the Gracchi to Sulla period. The Samnite Wars are a bit more sketchy.
Yeah, we don't have any like Plutarch biographies of Corvus, I don't think.
I don't think so. But that can mean it can be rich in other ways because you get to talk more about that. That's one of the things that I wondered about for the book is who were the main sources you were using, and how did you sort of decide how you would treat their credibility or their utility? Because there's a lot of things going on with people writing about that period.
Yeah, so there's four main sources for this particular period. And it is, it's Plutarch, it's Appian, Sallust, and Cicero. And then Cicero's like, you know, Cicero does a lot, like Cicero, unlike the other three, didn't write like a straight history of any of this stuff. But he had so much commentary on most of these characters and most of the events of the period that he's filling in all kinds of critical gaps. So yeah, it's really difficult to try to balance like what is true with what is more, like in Plutarch's case, it's like, when is he actually telling you the truth, and when is he just trying to make a moral point? That's always the problem with Plutarch. And then with Sallust, it's like, is he telling the truth, or is he just grinding an axe? Because Sallust had like a bunch of axes to grind, and he was grinding the hell out of them. And then Appian, now you're getting into, he's writing, you know, in the 200s AD, now you're getting to being centuries removed from the fact. And, you know, Appian provided, I think, what I would consider to be the most reliable account of things, just in the, like, which author would I go to say, you know, I generally speaking, he's getting me from point A to point B in a reliable way. I think Appian was kind of a touchstone throughout the writing of the whole book.
Right.
And then you counterbalance that with the fact that Sallust, even though he had access to Grind, was just, you know, he's just a generation later.
Yeah.
And Cicero is the same way, where Cicero has his own access to Grind, but he's just a generation later. And Cicero in particular was also, like, really kind of obsessed with if he was going to be working at all in historical settings, like, you know, his dialogues are set.
Yes.
You know, like I forget which one it is now off the top of my head, but there's one that's set, like, on the eve of Scipio Aemilianus's death. And then On the Orators is set with, just right there on the edge of the social war. And he was really concerned about getting the details right. Mm-hmm. So you rely and then you just kind of mash them all together and be like, okay, this is basically the story. And if you come across contradictory things, you try to explore them a little bit. Or you just make a judgment call about which one was written better.
Yeah. I mean, there's sometimes sounds nicer. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's like, well, that's a really juicy quote from Sallust right there. So, like, let's go with Sallust.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the things that I liked about your podcasts. Well, I've always, I mean, I like lots of things about your podcast, but in particular, when I first started listening to History of Rome, which I'm going to tell you right up front, I did because I teach Roman history and I sort of found it. And I think, Mark, you found it first.
It.
Yeah. And you recommended it to me. And I started listening not because I particularly like narrative history. I'm going to confess, I'm not actually usually much of a fan of narrative history. It kind of isn't my thing. And I started listening to it thinking, okay, let's just check how good this is, because if it's good, I can make my students listen to it and then I don't have to do this in class and exactly. I can focus on the thematic stuff that I like. And then I got hooked. So I started listening to it, and it even though I theoretically am fully trained in the period, it was very useful for reminding me of stuff. And also the High Empire, I really never spent much time on. So that was really, really helpful for me. But what I was going to say is that as soon as I started hearing, especially in your early episodes, the way you treated the problem of sources, you know, when you talked about Livy, using Livy for the early period of the kings and what the issues were, you didn't make a huge deal of it. You didn't footnote every sentence you referenced a primary source in. But that was always up front that, you know, you were making decisions about what kinds of sources you were using and telling the stories, even though sometimes you knew that they weren't likely to be true, but they were good stories or they showed us something about the mindset of the time or whatever. And I always found that really, really good, because that's something that I stress so much with students, is how to read and think about primary sources in a critical way. And so I really appreciate that about that podcast, and you've done the same in the Revolutions. And so I'm interested to see this in the book as well, because you have to balance that, like, how do you tell a narrative in a way that's interesting and engaging, without spending every 5 seconds saying, oh, but of course that might not have happened. Or, well, you know, that might have just been because he hated him or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And in the history of Rome, like, the number of times that I was like, oh, there's two versions of what happened next, or like, or there's three versions of what happened next. You know, I had so much room to sprawl out on, that I could really be like, okay, well, here's one version of how it happened. Here's another version of how it happened. Yeah. Here's another version of how it happened. I will say, though, just to warn you, because this had to be a little bit of a tighter ship, that I do make some choices about which version I'm going to follow without. There's not going to be quite
as much. You don't signal everyone.
Like, yeah. You know, the editors are like, come on now, we're trying to write a book for the people here. You can't.
Oh, no, exactly.
You can't just sprawl for 1,000 pages of Camille. No, that even though the original versions of it, it's like I'm going down all those little rabbit holes.
But that does bring up the question that I had. You know, I'm interested about the process here. How did you kind of rework material from a sort of spoken genre to a written genre? I mean, obviously, there's a certain amount of expansion. You cover this period in about, I think, 7 or 8 episodes. So obviously, there's expansion involved there. But also, I'm thinking in change of genre. How do you engage a reader in a way that you know, in a different way than you would engage a listening audience?
The first thing is that I started with a blank piece of paper for the book, right? Like I never was repurposing material from the history of Rome. I didn't start from the episodes that I had already written. I wrote it from scratch, and to the point of like, and you just had to do this, right? You would do this anyway, but I reread everything again. Like I reread all of Appian. I reread all of Plutarch. I was working. So I was creating the book without any reference at all to what was in the history of Rome. And I mean, to the point, there's definitely going to be like one or two things in the book. And I'm looking forward to getting these emails from people. They're like, well, and you know, in the history of Rome, you said this. And then in the book, you said this, like, which is true. You guys, what's true is what I wrote in the book. You know, there's definitely a few things where if I could go back to the history of Rome, you know, I would want to change them a little bit. It's like, oh, wow, I kind of, ooh, whoops. But I was writing it from scratch completely because, I wanted to make sure that I was covering it in with new and fresh eyes, right? I didn't want to be at all bound by what I had written before. The challenge just for writing a book in general is to like, how do you keep people reading from one sentence to the next? How do you keep people turning the pages? And with the podcast, you know, that's very easy. I just keep talking. That's how you keep the listener engaged. Like that's how you keep the story moving forward is I just get to keep talking. So I've been writing, you know, podcasts for 10 years. I've written like 1.5 million words. Mm-hmm. I think it's like the combined total transcripts of everything from the history of Roman revolutions. And I always know whatever I'm writing, I can emphasize in a certain way, or I can, if the sentence is a little convoluted, I can just kind of keep powering through it. And so there's a couple of more layers of editing that I don't have to really worry about when it comes to the podcast, that when it comes to the book, you know, you really, like, I just kept squeezing the prose and squeezing the prose and squeezing the prose to make sure that the sentences were reading clearly and just would keep going. Right. Because I'm not going to be there in your ear. I'm not going to be able to follow you around and like read the book to you. There's obviously going to be an audiobook version of it, but like mostly people are just going to be sitting in a chair and reading it. And I, you know, the sentences need to do the work for me.
Yeah. So you found that in a different process or just sort of an adjustment of what you'd already been doing, as you say, where you did more revisions?
Yeah, it was an adjustment of what I was already doing. There's much, much more on the revision side than there usually is for a podcast. Cause you know, I gotta knock out an episode every week.
Yeah.
and you know, when it comes to the transcripts, you know, I'll write a rough draft, then I'll edit it, then I'll edit it again. And now it's, you know, Saturday, Sunday. Now I have to record because I'm, you know, that's the time for it. So this, I had a lot more time to really go back over it like over and over again, which is, you know, good and bad because I mean, writers, I could revise anything
again and again,
indefinitely. Yeah. Like if I was given an unlimited amount of time, I'd still be on like episode one of the history of Rome because I wouldn't be done with it. So it's actually a nice thing that I have to knock out episodes every week. It keeps me from getting too bogged down in, oh, should that be that word or that word?
Yeah. Yeah. Placing commas, which is one of the silliest things to do for a spoken script, but I still obsess over it.
This is really funny. I actually discovered, my editor discovered on my behalf, that I don't use commas for anything.
Really?
I just, yeah, sure. I write and I just like, I'm writing the sentence for myself.
Right.
So I know how it reads. And when I submitted the first draft of the book, like when I was finally done with everything and I was like, this is my contractual, you know, time that I am submitting the book to you, you know, my editor was reading it and she was like, you just don't use commas at all, do you? And I was like, oh, I never really thought about it. And so we had a whole process of
putting the commas in.
This is the thing, like the readers aren't going to know how this, you know, three line sentence is supposed to actually read. So a comma here and there would actually be helpful. So that's, you know, one of those little things that I never thought about it because I never use them for myself.
That's interesting. I work on the page so much that I'm obsessive about commas because I can't read a script properly if I don't have my pauses in, if you see what I mean. Like for me, that's performance markings. It's almost like a time signature or something. So
yeah. And you would think that I would have commas all over the place so that I would know when to pause or whenever. But I guess apparently it was just, I just insert them like automatically in my head. It's
well, it was very Roman of you.
Never conscious of.
Yeah. You do just fine in a world before punctuation.
I do use spaces. I do.
Oh, well, that's kind of wimpy, but I guess we'll accept that.
I'm not fully Roman. Yeah.
Yeah. If you can capitalize and put spaces between words, you don't fully understand your language, I'm sure. And my students always are completely blown away when you show them in the first intro to Latin class, well, this is what it would look like if your editors weren't so nice to you and printed the Latin the way it had been written in the first place. It's like, no, I can't do that.
Yeah, I've never quite understood how they did it.
Yeah.
But that's just probably because, you know, we've been stamped a certain way.
Yeah. You get used to what you're used to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So one thing we like to kind of get into with all of our guests is we're interested in connections between life and work and different areas of what you do. And I was wondering if there are any fortuitous or unexpected connections that you sort of came across, you know, as you progress through the podcasts and doing the books and
moving into podcasting
in the first place. Yeah.
Well, certainly when I started podcasting, which was, you know, July of 2007.
Right.
So I just had my 10th anniversary as a podcaster. I started it as a hobby. It was just a thing to do.
Yeah.
It was an interesting thing to do on the weekends. Like I had all of this, I'd been reading all these ancient sources. I kind of wanted to, I always have like a creative drive to do something. And this was just going to be like the something else that I did. Mm-hmm. But if you told me like in July of 2007, guess what, dude, like you, this is your career. Like you actually just started your career. I would have been like, what are you talking about? Like, no, this is something I'll do for a little while and then I'll just move on. Like, it's probably not even gonna be a thing. Mm-hmm. So to have it just slowly but surely turn into doing it on the side while I worked full time, and then, you know, there started being enough ad revenue from Audible once that sort of kicked in that it became a part-time job. And then later, you know, after the History of Rome and moving over to Revolutions, when I made that move, it was like, okay, I'm going to try to do this. I'm going to see if I can make enough money just from the podcast to do it full time. And that worked somehow. I still don't even know like how it worked. And as I've said, you know, around in my life, just to people that I know, it's like, you know, I work all the time, but I don't have a job. I don't feel like I have a job, because I am just doing what I would normally do. I read stacks of books and I make notes and I learn about history and then I explain it to people. And that's just what I would be doing normally. That's just what I did in bars. Like, we would just be sitting around in the bar and I'd be yelling at you about Cromwell or something. but now I get to do it. Now I get to do it in a microphone and have it make a living. So, the whole thing has been very, it's one of those things where when you look back on it, it looks like a very logical procession and like something that maybe I had planned out or there was some kind of roadmap at work, but it really, there was never a roadmap to any of it.
Yeah. I mean, that's a little lesson for looking back on historical progress, isn't it? It looks like it all goes in an obvious direction. And sometimes...
Right. Well, you know, that's actually like one of the things I like to do with the shows is to always try to tell like whatever's happening in whatever given episode to as much as possible, try to tell it from their perspective without knowing the future, without knowing how it's going to turn out. Because there's always at any given moment, there's always like seven or eight competing versions of what could possibly happen next. Mm-hmm. And only one of them ultimately is successful. And then we tell that version of it because it was the one that was successful without giving all the little like, oh, it could have gone this way and it could have gone this way. And then these guys were trying to actually make it go this other way. So I always try to keep that in mind. And and that is true that's been a life experience of mine, that I think that is a bit informed by how my own, certainly this is not what I mean, it's like when I was a kid, I was like, eventually I'll write a book. but how I got from being a kid who wanted to write a book to actually having a book, like, that process is wow.
Not perhaps what you expect.
not at all.
What did you? I know that when you started History of Rome, were you in grad school, or I'm trying to remember now, because you did talk about it a little bit when you were, but it's, I haven't re-listened to the early episodes now.
Well, one of the things that got me going on the History of Rome, like why I was like, this is something I should, is I was going to go back and get a master's in education.
Right.
I basically was at the point, I was in my mid 20s, and I was like, you know what, I should go be like a history teacher, social studies teacher, like all, cause I mean, even like politics and government and all that stuff is really interesting to me. So I was, I was kind of thinking I would go back and get a master's in education and be, you know, essentially a social studies teacher. And that the history of Rome would be something that would be, you know, like in a way, like an extracurricular activity on the resume. Right. Like, okay, I graduated from school a couple years ago. I've just been kind of kicking around. So what's going to recommend me above other candidates? And maybe the fact that I have this podcast that I do about Roman history would be something that would recommend me. And then that step just never wound up being taken. There were some things that happened in my personal life that kind of derailed me from that path anyway. And then the show just kept being a constant. While everything else around me was kind of changing, the show itself became a constant. And then the show became, which very quickly stopped being a means to an end and just became an end unto itself.
I was listening to another interview you were doing, the one on A History on Fire, I think. And you talked about how when you started podcasting, there were other history podcasts around. And since yours was one of the first podcasts I started listening to, I think I listened to a couple others, but they were more entertainment ones right at the beginning. I was trying to reconstruct my own podcast listening history, and I've now completely forgotten what order I started finding things in. But I don't remember specifically what was on the ground. What podcasts were you listening to before you started History of Rome? What made you even know that podcasts were a thing? And did any of them kind of shape the way you decided to do at least the early part of History of Rome?
Yeah, sure. So I discovered all of this. It was around 2006, 2007. Yeah. And the thing that actually got me over to podcasting was that my sister-in-law had told me that there was this new thing where, like, Stanford and MIT were starting to just release for free, like, lectures from professors, like classroom lectures, which is probably the beginning of the mass online
open online courses, the MOOCs.
Yes. Yeah, massive open online courses, like the very nascent beginning of that, which is just like, we're going to record lectures and just put them up on the website for free.
Right.
So I was like, wow, that seems like a great way to just, you know, keep learning things. So I was obviously exploring whatever history and philosophy stuff I could find. And then that bumped me over to 12 Byzantine Rulers by Lars Brownworth. Right. So that was out right at that time. And I was like, well, this is a whole show. And I think that was probably like the most influential show in terms of like how the original History of Rome started to play out. But I tell that story a lot, and you know, people know that how much I was influenced by him, and Lars blurbed the book for me, which was an absolutely lovely, lovely thing. It means a lot to me. But the other side of it that I rarely tell this part is that there were a lot of other podcasts that were out there that I would click on and I would listen to them, and they just weren't that good.
Right.
They were very amateurish. You could tell that they were clunky and not very well done. So I obviously won't name any of those because that would be rude. But it was sitting there like listening to something that was kind of inspiring, like 12 Byzantine Rulers, and then having other podcasts that were on iTunes that just weren't that good. And I was like, okay, I might not be as good as the best podcast, but I can certainly do a better job than whatever these guys are up to. So that kind of gave me it gave me like at least a boost of confidence that, like, you know,
there was space for you
having some,
Yeah.
Yeah, there was. And like, obviously there's no quality control.
Nobody's going to refuse you the option of doing this.
Yeah. As long as I'm not sitting there just like screaming obscenities into a microphone.
They're going to put it up.
Probably they're just going to approve it and put it up. Yeah. Cause like, and I think I can do a better job than these people. And I think that wound up being true.
Yeah. So in History of Rome, you were definitely doing a narrative history, though, as the you'd break aside sometimes when it was appropriate to talk about larger thematic stuff. When you moved on to revolutions, each of the revolutions is a narrative history, but in a sense, you're doing overall thematic history. You're obviously doing revolutions. You're talking about revolutions. What do you sort of see as the benefits of doing a more narrative or more chronological approach versus a more thematic approach? And do you kind of try to balance those, or do you have a preference when you're doing them?
Well, in my opinion, I think a narrative history is much more accessible,
right,
to people, right? If this is like your entry point into history, where you're learning about something new for the first time, I think it's way more accessible to be like, okay, we're gonna start at this point. Here are the people who were involved. Here's the order of events that it happened in. You know, then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. And once you have that grounding of like the who, what, when, where, like the basic, like, you know, for lack of a better word, you know, the plot elements, then all of the thematic stuff or more, you know, specialized takes or zooming in on some particular aspect of it or pulling back and trying to draw some like bigger conclusions, I think all of that is much easier once you have the basic narrative structure in your head that you can like hang things on.
Right.
And most of what I do, since I'm like, you know, I'm a popularizer of history or a popular historian, that, you know, most people are coming at this not knowing anything about the subject matter.
Right.
So I think that definitely narrative history is a great way, to get people on board with the program of history being amazing and awesome and worth exploring all the time. So it's great propaganda for the discipline. So I think that's a big part of it. And then also, I there are thematic things that you want to introduce, or you do want to get, if you do want to get into more analytical points, I think it's easier to peel off from a narrative and take a look at where we are and where we're going, rather than starting from here's a nebulous concept like revolutions, and I'll try to fit things into it. It's more like, here's all the things that happened, and then we can, at the very end, like, I hope to have some sort of like grand theory of revolution or progression of revolutions.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, because I do think you do seem to be kind of drawing, you know, obviously you can't go from one to the next without starting to see parallels or larger points. I mean, and you mentioned those as some of them as they come up. Do you have that kind of a sense for Rome? I mean, having done that big sweep of immense amount of history and immense number of people, were there things that at the end you feel like you sort of conclusions, that's a strong word, but conclusions you can draw about Roman history, about history in general, that you didn't feel like you had that kind of understanding when you went in?
Yeah. Well, about the Romans in particular, I remember one of my big takeaways from there was like two that really developed along the way when it came particularly to the Romans, and they're both kind of linked to each other. As you walk through Roman history from the beginning to the end, the Romans were always really successful and did really well when they were working on kind of a meritocratic system, right? When the idea was that the like sort of the best man for the job would get the job, then the job would get done. And Rome was always struggling, and at its worst, when they were like, oh, well, you're the son of a noble, son of a noble, son of a noble, so we're going to give you command of this army. And then that guy's an idiot and he doesn't know anything. Then things would start to go badly for them.
Right.
And their socio-political economic structures were always at risk of falling apart when whatever elite happened to be in power tried to block anybody else from sharing in the spoils or sharing in the wealth or sharing in the power. And they always, Rome always flourished whenever they were like, you know, oh yeah, of course you can come in. You know, even if it wasn't exactly like that well thought out, just the process of history. Anytime Rome became sort of a meritocracy, it flourished. Anytime it became a close-minded elite, it started to struggle. So that was a big part of it. And then the corollary to that is how ethnically diverse Rome was, mm-hmm. and how well actually the Roman idea, right? Like Rome stopped being for just the Romans fairly early on, where the ideas of citizenship and law, infrastructure, how you plan a community, how you run an army, like these became ideas that were as imbibable in Syria as they were in Spain, as they were in Britain, as they were in Algeria. Like it became like almost like a universal plug-in, mm-hmm. right? You could take like the Roman mentality, and really, so now it's like the Greco-Roman mentality, because you have like the Romans are doing the political infrastructure, military stuff linked to like Greek philosophy and Greek culture and Greek ideas. Like once those two things combined, that became instantly, it became almost a universally adaptable mm-hmm. plug-in. And it's the same sort of thing where the Romans did well and flourished anytime that they just assimilated some new group that they encountered or some new group of migrants who came into the borders, which happened like all the time, and started to struggle quite badly when they were like, oh no, you're somehow so different from us that we have to like destroy you or fight against you rather than accept you and stamp you with our Roman mentality. And that is a process that happened a number of times, especially during the empire, where, I mean, the empire, like I said, I have this great interest in, the crisis of the third century. I mean, that was a bunch of guys from Croatia who saved the empire, right? It was not like, oh, the Romans, the old stock Romans from the Palatine Hill, salvaged their empire. It was like, no, it was a bunch of like Illyrian peasants, who happened to have fully internalized the Roman idea and their place within the empire, and identified not with, you know, they didn't see Rome as like an other. They considered themselves to be as fully Roman as any actual ethnically Italian mm-hmm. Roman. And as long as Rome was like letting those people in and help them and like revive them and give them strength, they did well. And then at the end, when they just I think that they got way too closed up and tight at the end when those last runs of Germans and Goths and mm-hmm. Huns were coming over. I think they did a really poor job interacting with and assimilating those groups.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I certainly agree. And I think that it's even, it goes back not just to the empire, but Rome really was never anything but a group of people who came from diverse backgrounds and were assimilating into a larger group. I mean, not just in its mythical sense, of course, with the stories of Romulus and the asylum, but what you were talking about with the Samnite Wars in Italy. I mean, we think of Italy and Rome as being homogenous now, but it didn't feel that way to the Romans back when they were a city-state. They felt like it wasn't homogenous. There were non-Indo-Europeans sitting just up north of them and all the rest of it. And they were already willing to incorporate large groups of people in a way that very few of the surrounding peoples were. And that was all, you know, from the very beginning. And I agree that it was failure to do so whenever they got too up on themselves as being, you know, one particular pure group was a real flaw in there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the Roman idea is anybody can be Roman.
Yeah.
Right? Like by the time of the empire, anybody can be Roman, and you should want to be Roman. And you know, you learn Greek or you learn Latin so you can communicate with each other, but everybody did. Mm-hmm. And then it's just fine.
Yeah.
It worked. I mean, there's a reason why it lasted for 1,000 years, or you know, you tack the Byzantines onto it another 1,000 years. I mean, you don't get an empire that lasts for arguably 2,000 years without being able to incorporate new groups and new ideas. You just can't do it.
Mm-hmm. They're all about being exclusive and hierarchical, but not about saying you can't be Roman. It's all about
exactly.
You know, free or unfree, what your rank is, all of those things. And they get more and more hierarchical. But it's not about saying you can't be Roman. And I do think that it's not really even a virtue so much. It's not that they were being particularly intentionally inclusive. They just saw it as a strength.
Right. And it's hard to tell even like how much they actively thought this through, mm-hmm. or if it was just something very subconscious about how their worldview. But I mean, you take even like the slaves, like the Romans were very pretty open to like freedmen just being freedmen, mm-hmm. right? Like, you could be a slave, later you were freedman, and then your status was changed. There was no like, there's no genetic or racial basis to slavery. It was a legal state. And then the son of a freedman, you get two generations past, and like, who even cares?
Yep. No, absolutely.
You have a slave in your past. Whereas we today, you know, we have a tendency to, you know, once you are a certain thing, the United States, and I think the West in general, has actually done a fairly decent job with this. With you know, birthright citizenship, you know, just if you're born here, guess what, you're an American.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually been quite a strength for the United States, in a way that, you know, you go back to some of the old countries. I know Germany has this problem,
mm-hmm. Switzerland.
Where they don't have, yeah, where they're like, if even if you were born here, you're not a citizen, and even your children and your children's children, you could have a family living in some of those Central European countries for like a century, and they're still like outside.
Mm-hmm.
Full citizenship, which seems to me probably because I'm an American who thinks things like that are crazy, because if you're born here, you're a citizen. That's how it works for us.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think those are dangerous things to be playing around with.
Yeah, agreed. No, and the I think it's part of the tension and the interest of the Roman culture that being a slave or being free is this absolutely drastic, hugely important thing in your status, and yet is also permeable. And, you know, at the same time, and tension, I guess, is a really crucial mentality of the Romans, and gives them a lot of flexibility in a way that, I mean, the rest of the Mediterranean thought they were extremely weird for that permeability of status. And yet, obviously, it worked pretty well.
Well, one of them won.
Yeah.
And the rest of them were then conquered. Yeah. So
not to, you know, embed moral superiority in military strength, but you can't argue with the results. Yeah.
So you seem to kind of draw a distinction between, you know, a historian and a public historian, or, we could maybe say more broadly, a teacher. Do you feel that, because I certainly have this feeling, you know, what I do in the classroom is a different mode from what I do in podcasts and putting out videos on YouTube. Do you see that distinction, or is it all one to you?
Well, for me, the two got merged, where like I am now a professional historian only in the sense that I produce these podcasts, and I mean, I now have a book that's going to be coming out, but I'm at least aware of it, because I did wind up going back to grad school. Mm-hmm. I had to drop out of grad school. I kept trying to get back into it, and then just like life would pull me in a different direction. That I at least have always drawn a distinction between like a professional historian, right? And then somebody like me, who you would want to put some kind of qualifier on it. I'm a history writer. I'm a history podcaster. I'm a popularizer of history. I'm a narrative, you know, a nonfiction narrative writer who works in history. There's all these like qualifiers that you want to put on it, because what a historian does is take something that we know nothing about and go dig around in the archives and do interviews and look at, you know, really like sketchy primary source material that nobody's handled before or maybe hasn't looked at in a new light in a long time, and produce studies and new information that then somebody like me can come along and gather up all these secondary sources to tell like the world about what is going on in history. Like here's what we know about history. Here are the things that we've discovered. Here's the story as we know it so far. But, you know, at no point in the history of Rome or revolutions have I ever needed to dig around in an archive and go explore and discover like new things. That's what a historian does. So I've always been very careful to not call myself a historian, as opposed to a popularizer of history, is I guess the best way that I could possibly put it.
Do you ever think of yourself as a teacher?
Oh, as a teacher, yeah, yeah. I would consider myself to be a teacher of history. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, because that's sort of what I think of. Not exactly the same. You're not giving tests yet. You can start.
Right. I keep like a rhetorical thing I use. Like, don't worry about this guy. He's not going to be on the test.
Yeah.
but I never. There are no tests or anything. But yeah, I would consider myself to be like, yeah, as somebody who is producing content that will teach people about whatever area I happen to be covering. And my hope is that, and my expectation when it comes to like who is listening to the show is people who know nothing, who want to know something and then will walk out knowing something. Right. That's like my intended audience. Although you would have been like the, I have two like audience members in mind, or two listeners in mind. There's when I write, there's the people who know nothing and I have to explain it to them. Like that's the principal audience. But then I also keep in mind like somebody who knows something about the subject, who is going to be listening to it to like see if I'm doing it right. and all I really have ever wanted from those people is for them to listen to like, you know, and go, that was all right. That was pretty good. Yeah. You said the right people and you got the dates right. And, you know, you hit the correct things, you know? So I always try to keep those people in mind too.
Well, from the number of people I know who are in the field in one way or another, or grad students, or who went into studies because of the history of Rome, I think you're doing okay on that one. I can't speak for revolutions, of course, because I am completely clueless on all of the revolutions you've covered so far. But for Rome, at least as far as I know, I think you did just fine.
Thank you. Well, I apologize as always for the pronunciation, but that's not my job. It'll be your guys. You guys can be like, you can use me as an object. You hear how Mike did it? You see how wrong that is? Like he actually managed to go in the wrong direction on every single story.
No, that's not my, that's not a particular pet peeve of mine. I'm pretty good at mispronouncing even stuff that I technically know very well how to say. In fact, one of my real problems is getting halfway through a word and realizing I don't know whether I'm saying it in English, Greek, or Latin, and getting all three of them mixed up in the wrong way. So yeah.
Well, because of how much work I've done in French history now, I've actually been studying French.
Oh, right.
And so I've been learning French, and then I, for the book, like I had to do the audio book, which is, you know, there's tons of Latin pronunciation in there. And yeah, like the divergence of the way that French treats every like C's and G's and everything in the way that Latin does. So I'm like, I would constantly get confused whether I was trying to pronounce this in French or in Latin, which are like 180 degrees opposite.
Oh, I know. Because we're in Canada and, you know, and we're in particular in Sudbury, which is Northern Ontario, and it's a very French area. There's a lot. It's a very Franco-Ontarian area. So most of my students know French either as a first or twinned language or very well. And so as soon as whenever I'm teaching Latin, we have to spend quite a long time not saying a instead of et, and learning that we have to pronounce we have to pronounce all the E's instead of leaving out half of them.
you've got to keep going to the end of the word. You can't
every
just
vowel.
You can't just bail halfway through and move on.
Yeah, because it's as you say, and the, you know, so many of the words look in the qui and quad are and qua are really hard because qui looks like key, and that's a whole set of very specific French speaker problems with Latin.
That's really interesting.
Interesting. I'm sure it must be completely, you know, a similar set for people who teach in areas where everybody knows Spanish, and there must be a similar kind of overlap problem. But I know the French.
Yeah, there's some people that are have been going through this class with me that were either native Spanish speakers or had already learned it, and they have a real problem with this. What do they call it? Français. Okay. I think it's what they call it. Français Espagnol, where they'll get into it and just start mangling pronunciation and emphasis.
Yeah.
Because in that case, it all like literally looks and is supposed to almost sound the same.
For sure.
So one feeling that I have, and I'm curious to know if this is your experience as well, is that I think academics in the humanities are not doing a great job of speaking to the public. And so there is this area for successful podcasts and video channels to kind of move into that area, since this, you know, in the sciences, there's so much about popularizers of science, and they're doing really well. A lot of scientists are, you know, kind of getting out there, becoming public figures. But the humanities academics don't seem to be terribly interested in doing that. Do you kind of agree? Do you sort of feel that there's a lack of that out there?
I certainly do. Yeah. No, I'm not technically going to complain about it.
Yes. Well, it's given you an opportunity.
It's given me a wide open opportunity to act as a go-between, I guess, between the public and the humanities departments, especially like the history departments, that I will go read their monographs and their articles, their journal articles, and I will explain them to you. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's definitely, you know, a lack of it. And I've only touched on, you know, experiences in grad school. You know, I've been a grad student, I've been inside, you know, the class, I've been a TA for a professor and all that. And I don't know if it's not quite snobbery, but whenever there is somebody who, like, there's one department in particular that I won't like mention any name here, but you know, there's a department there is full of historians, and one of them happens to be quite good at writing popular histories and is kind of a prominent public intellectual, and everybody else in the department hates him, I guess, because he's not doing his real job as a real historian. He's out there just kind of like writing, you know, popular books to be on TV, which they don't consider to be the real work of a real historian. So, you know, I don't want to paint them all with a broad brush, because I've had plenty of, you know, academics and PhDs and doctors be like, you're doing a great job, and, you know, this work is like really important. But I think that there's plenty who just kind of, they honestly could care less about what the plebs think.
It's one of the things that has struck me when in balancing. So we've been, you know, Mark started by making videos, then we moved into doing a podcast sort of based around that, and we've been doing it. You know, I teach at a university, I'm a full-time prof, and trying to sort of figure out where on my resume, and this, it sounds really pragmatic, but this is part of the issue, I think, where to put video, the work I help Mark with in videos or the work we do on the podcast, where that goes. And, you know, it can go broadly under outreach, but that's just a really kind of wimpy and meaningless term. What does it mean when you're doing outreach, public intellectual activity? And I think that that's actually, and I've been looking around for sort of models of other people who are doing it. And when I look at, say, history podcasts, of which there are a lot now, there's a history of everywhere, which is great, I don't know that I have yet found one that's by a working academic. someone who, you know, some of them are grad students, have been grad students, in terms of the narrative histories or the sort of doing a broad scope of a historical topic, I can't think of one that's by a working academic.
Yeah.
And I think that's really interesting. I don't know how much of it is what you're talking about of attitude, and I think probably some of it is. I think some of it is just time. It's a lot of work, as you know.
Yeah, I mean, this is a full-time job, what I do right now, right, for sure.
Yeah, and, you know, people who are working academics generally often have full-time jobs. Or even if they are not, you know, tenure-track employed, they may even have a more than full-time job, even if they're getting less than full-time pay. So in terms of time, I think that's part of it. But I also wonder, you know, what that gap is. I think it's great that there's lots of people who are what one might call amateurs, though I don't want to make that sound like it's in any way dismissive. It isn't. But people who are not professionals in their field who are doing these things, I think that's great. But it's interesting that there's sort of this dichotomy between people who are professional in their discipline and then people who are doing the work by which most people at this point, or many people at this point, are probably getting their information about those disciplines.
Yeah, I read there was, I forget what her name is now, and that makes me feel bad. But on Twitter, there was just a woman who, she's a sociologist, who was actually talking about this a bit. And she was saying that, like you say, on with like just the straight like brass tacks of the resume, you know, if you're trying to do a PhD, if you're trying to get into a PhD program or then complete your PhD, and then once you have your PhD, you're trying to get onto tenure track or you're trying to get into university, like there's none of your public intellectual activities, none of that public outreach stuff, no podcast is ever going to count for what you're trying to do with your career. So it's just like you prioritize what it is that you need to do to fulfill your own, you know, hopes and ambitions and dreams about what you want to be able to do with your life. So it's not, you know, it's not necessarily, oh, I'm just a snob, even though I just portrayed some of them as that way. But
there's, well, I think there is some of that for sure, but it's not the only aspect.
But there's also just a really like, you know, there are priorities that need to be made. And if you're going to devote your time to anything, you need to be devoting your time to the thing that's going to keep you moving forward.
But that snobbery, of course, is part of the problem. The reason these things don't count on your resume and they don't count toward the job is because they're not considered real intellectual work or real scholarship. And that's an ongoing problem. And I do know a bunch of academics who have podcasts. I should hasten to add, I do actually know of quite a lot of academic-based podcasts, but they tend to be very inside baseball kind of podcasts, but not actually inside baseball. But they're, you know, about interviews with people. How do you get into your PhD topic? Or how did you interviews with researchers or discussions about philosophical ideas? Now, they may be open to the general public, and they sometimes are definitely framed as being about general public, but they're very much focused on, here's the research I do, I'm disseminating my research to the world. Now, that's great. I'm not saying that, but so it seems like there's some movement saying, okay, podcasts that are very specifically about the new research you're doing, that counts as at least a certain kind of scholarship that people are starting, some of the younger scholars are starting to get sort of rewarded for. But if it's in any way just a synthesis of material or doesn't sort of represent new information, then no, that still doesn't count. That's not scholarship. And I think that's where the fault line lies now. There's some recognition that getting your own scholarship out there is a valuable move. But doing more of the sort of broad picture or the synthesis or what I think of as sort of teaching, but moving out of the classroom, doesn't seem to register yet.
Yeah. And I think that this is something that's been the case. You know, I think this is a tension or whatever that has been around since the dawn of time, at least when it comes to universities, where there's just always going to be a space for somebody like me who is incredibly passionate about subjects, is able to become highly literate in a topic and then present it. And then with an eye always on then being able to turn it around and disseminate the information, because I think it's just an unqualified public good for, especially with history,
for
the citizens of a country to be literate in history, to have long perspectives, to know that, you know, here's how we got here. And oh, by the way, like there's still a long ways to go and we actually have no idea where we're going. Mm-hmm. Rather than living, you know, what history gives you is it breaks you out of this like 3 month. I feel like most people live in like a 6 month bubble where if it was more than 3 months ago, it's ancient history. And if it's more than 3 months in the future, it's like what are you even talking about?
Exist.
That's like so far away. It doesn't even exist. And I think that history just gives you like a broader perspective that is just good. And so people like me, I think are always going to have a place, even if we do then get called like amateur historians, which is fine. I'm learning to live.
Yeah. That's why I hesitated on the word, because I don't want to say it in some way but yeah.
Cause you know, reviews of the book have started to come out, and you know, they will, you know, quite like sort of accurately be like, oh, this is, you know, amateur historian Mike Duncan has done a lovely job with this book. It's great. I'm like, yeah, I do it for a living, but you're right. You know, I'm not a chaired PhD at Cambridge or anything like that. So in that sense, I'm amateur, but I do it for a living. You know, I do it for a living.
I would, in my outside perspective on you, I would say you started as an amateur historian. That was where you came to the history of Rome as an amateur. That is someone who loved it and wanted to get into it. I wouldn't personally call you an amateur historian now. What I would say is that you are not a working academic. But that's very different than saying whether you're a professional historian or not. You know, that's a division. But of course, I'm inside a system that makes divisions on the most tiny and petty of grounds. So of course I'm good at dividing things up.
I don't want to like step on anybody's toes. Having a good relationship with the academic community. So I'm always, that's fine. I'm an amateur.
As I said, I don't think you are anymore, but I mean, we were all amateurs when we came to it. I was an amateur classicist when I was an undergrad because I certainly wasn't being paid for it. That's for sure. For darn sure. And I came to it because I loved it. And I mean, that's the best reason for anyone to come to a subject. You know, this is me being all etymological about it. And I can't help using amateur to mean a lover of rather than meaning not good at, which is, I think, what too many people use amateur to mean. Driven by a love of it rather than driven immediately by a desire to make a living at it. That comes later.
That's a lovely distinction, and I'm right.
So when you think of being, when you're called an amateur historian, just think of it as being saying that you are doing it for the love,
right?
And then hopefully for the income too.
Right.
That's where the transition has come.
Definitely nice. I do have kids. Yeah. I do have kids and a mortgage.
Yeah. On that point about history and the sort of literate citizen, one of the common threads that I think about a lot when I think about Rome, but have been noticing also in particular in your most recent set of revolutions discussions, the 1848 revolutions, is there's a sort of common thread of how people use history. That is, sure, now, and we can talk about that in a moment, maybe, but when we look back on history, we can look at the Romans using history, their own history, the history of other peoples, for all sorts of purposes. And I think of this because of the revolutions you're looking at right now, and you're talking about how the sort of the histories that were coming out about the first French Revolution are impacting how the course of revolutions are going on throughout Europe, a generation later. So do you sort of see that as a thread that goes through the work you've been, the periods you look at, or how do people use history?
I would definitely say that is a common theme. it's becoming more apparent in the 19th century because you really have the beginning of what I would consider to be modern histories, not until like the 18th century.
Right? Yeah.
I mean,
like
Gibbon is among, you know, the beginners of it. You know, Hume wrote a great, history of England, that was very, very popular and influential. So you started having those sort of more professional, like we're going to study history and then teach you about it and then have, but those works were all very much of their time, right? Like Gibbon was making a point about the Roman Empire, but he was also making a point about Enlightenment philosophy. Yeah. Hume was doing the same thing. So there is now starting to be a plethora of historical books available, all of which I think at this point are being, I still don't think in 1848 you have any kind of sense of the historian as somebody who is trying to completely remove themselves from the present and only present as truthful an account of a particular period or event or person as they can based on the available historical sources. Which I don't think that even I've been so you know, progressing slowly through the years that I'm not even sure when I would say in the grand scope of Western historiography when that mentality came into play, because all of these guys were writing histories and using the characters and events to put forward some sort of idea that they wanted for their contemporary audience. And that is a tradition that, of course, goes like all the way back to the Romans and the Greeks. Those guys, Plutarch and Sallust, they were all using history. And the Romans were incredibly literate in their own history, at least the literate Romans, at least among the political elite. They were all obsessed with their own history and loved their own history. But they were reading those history books and writing those history books to teach moral lessons. It was just how do we, let's have this guy give a speech. What speech is he giving? Do you have any idea what speech he gave? No, of course not. I'm writing a speech. Pericles' funeral oration is not Pericles. Mm-hmm. It's Thucydides who's talking. So that's a part of a grand scope of history, historiography, of using history to try to influence contemporary events and comment on contemporary events and try to teach people, not just about the past, but to teach people philosophy and ethics and all that.
And also to make political claims. I think of the Romans, they used history so much to make contemporary political claims, especially in the Republic, but certainly in the Empire too, their own family histories. What role do they have does the family have in the Republican history of Rome? And that affects whether or not they're going to be a good consul now and all of that. And then Augustus using his semi-fictitious views of history to reestablish the new Republic on historical grounds, this continual repurposing of history all the way through.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that still exists today. And I think this is one of the things, and I'm among those who thinks that, like the Storm Before the Storm is not like some vehicle for my own personal philosophy or anything like that. It is an attempt to use the past to shed some kind of historical light on contemporary events. Like there's a bunch of stuff that's going on right now in the world. If you look back at history, is there anything from history that can help shed light on what's going on now or give us some clue about how things turn out if we do it one way or do it another way? And I think that going back and finding historical events that, have some analogous setting or impact is a perfectly good thing to do. I think if we go too overboard on trying to remove history from present times, right? Number one, it's impossible because everybody, as much as you try to get away from it, you're always writing in your own period and according to your own generation's trends and ideas about what's important. But I think you can go too far with it and try to separate history from current events. And if you go too far in that direction, now we're just aimless and we don't really have any moorings and we don't have any light to help, guide us forward. So that's my thinking.
And that makes me think in a sort of roundabout way, about the Middle Ages, because, my background is as a medievalist, and I started listening to the history of Rome to sort of shore up my rather spotty knowledge of Roman history. But in a time when kind of medieval history is being used and often misused. I wonder if you'd ever thought about tackling a medieval period or a medieval topic by way of kind of correcting some of those misunderstandings of, you know, and misuses of the medieval.
Right. So I'm famously like, I of course, what did I do? I finished the History of Rome. I got to 476 AD. I said, okay, I'm leaving. And then when do I come back? Oh, like round about the Renaissance is when I pick it back up again.
There's a fine tradition of that.
I'm absolutely like just playing into that mentality. But those are just the two, it's just for me, those are the two periods that I've always been really interested in. It's like early modern history. And I mean, even that, like calling it early modern is, you know, has its prejudicial connotation, right? When it comes, you say like, oh, it was the Dark Ages, and was it really the Dark Ages? Well, I don't know. They didn't have running water anymore, but so, who knows? But does that even matter? So I have always personally, like for me, I would be kind of the opposite, where I always had a really good working understanding of Roman history. And then you get into the medieval stuff and it becomes very spotty for me. So I would be, I think, interested in listening to that podcast. and maybe I would want to do it, but you know, it would be entirely new material for me. Right. And like at this point in my career, I'm not sure that I would want to go dive that deeply in a 1,000-year period that I'm really not super comfortable with. Like, you know, there was Charlemagne and, you know, then Thomas Aquinas and let's see what happens next. Machiavelli. Like, oh, look, I was a political theory major.
Yeah.
That's a spotty period for political theory, I gotta say. Yeah, well, hey, man, there's Marcellus of Padua and, you know, some of the John of, you know, those guys.
Well, okay, so what you're saying is that you're not going to be doing the Peasants' Revolt anytime soon.
Right. I probably will not be doing a medieval history podcast. That would be well outside. I don't know what I'm going to do next. I'm in revolutions like forever.
There's now quite a few of them.
Yeah. And you know, exactly the same thing happened to me with revolutions that happened with the History of Rome, where it was, you know, it was a very manageable thing that I had taken on, and it was going to take three and a half years for me to get through. I was supposed to be done with revolutions by this point, and I'm like still trying to get 1848 properly off the ground. Still, I've got like four more to do. So I don't know what my next podcast is going to be at all, or if I, what happens next. I don't know. I can't even bother to think about it.
Yeah. And given, I'm speaking for you here, but given that 10 years ago, you probably couldn't envision exactly where you are now, it maybe doesn't make sense to worry too much about what you're going to be at 10 years from now. Who knows what new field or medium or technology or whatever there might be out there too.
Yeah, I've got, nobody actually probably read this, but famous, at least in my own mind, is when I got married, which was in the middle of the History of Rome, and we moved from Portland to Austin. I was like, okay, I'm going to take like 6 weeks off. And then I wrote a little thing about how here's the plan is I'm going to finish the History of Rome. It'll take me, you know, a couple more years. And then I really don't know what's going to happen next, because I mean, like, technology moves so fast, like podcasting probably won't even be a thing in 3 years. Like, we'll have all moved beyond it. Which is like the exact opposite happened. It became like, it suddenly like had its moment. And then now I'm looking back on it, I'm like, why did I ever think that like on-demand audio content would not have like an endless shelf life, which it probably will. Yeah. Which is like, it's so like you can know all the, you can want to know about history, but like your ability to predict the future is
limited, shall we say.
Very, very limited. As we were all sitting around being like, well, this Jeb Bush, Hillary Clinton presidential campaign sure is going to be a smear. Yeah. Like, I mean, like in 2015, we're writing like, is this going to be literally the most boring presidential election in modern history? And everybody agreed that it probably would be.
Oh, halcyon days.
Yeah, we know nothing.
No, and there is there's a danger in talking about things as being unprecedented, because it rarely is completely unprecedented, but it does feel like there's a number of things that we aren't unmoored from history. We can still look back to it, I think, but some stuff is a little harder to find parallels for right now.
Yeah, there's been a few continuity breaks, but yeah, as a historian and as somebody who has sort of made these mistakes like early on in my career, where I would say like this is the first time such and such ever happened, or like this was nothing like this had ever happened before, and you would get an email like 48 hours later that was like, oh, well, what about this and this and this? It's like, right, never ever ever say this is the first time that anything happened. Because like you just don't do it. You don't never write that sentence because there's always something. There is always something that you can point to and say, well, actually, this did happen before. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. On that point of sort of modern parallels and modern use, I noticed that on Twitter in particular, there's an awful lot of people who turn to you as the expert on Rome and now on revolutions anytime something comes up. And there's this impulse to keep finding the parallels, right? Who's the Julius Caesar of our time? Who's the, do you like that game? You seem to engage in it sometimes, and people certainly are always asking you, like, is Trump Caesar or is Trump Antony or is Trump, I don't know, God knows what people think he is. Is that a fun game to play?
Not really.
Yeah, I find it a little bit problematic. So I wondered.
Yeah, to be perfectly frank, like no, not really, because basically, the more specific you get, the less it works.
Yeah.
So you can say like broadly, I think that this is actually true. Is that broadly speaking, there are comparisons to be made between late Republican Rome and the early 21st century United States, and then kind of more broadly, just the West, like Western Europe, Canada, like United States. Like we're all kind of dealing with issues that are quite similar. You get into like, oh, well, is Trump Crassus? Like, no, he's not Crassus. Like that's not how it works. It's not... You don't literally cut and paste individuals. Like once you start to get into what, if you start trying to make it too granular, it doesn't work. And then especially like, Trump, Crassus was actually rich.
Yeah. He wasn't like, a bankrupt.
He was actually rich. He was actually like a really good, ruthless businessman.
Yeah.
He was actually a fairly talented politician who was able to accomplish quite a bit in his life. So no, Trump's not Crassus. And so generally speaking, is Trump this emperor or that emperor? Like most of that stuff I let go because it's not really worth, getting into, because none of it really works in the end, except Julius Caesar and Napoleon.
Right. Modeling themselves on someone.
Yeah.
Different issue.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, I will grant that Napoleon and Julius Caesar are like very similar figures.
Yeah. But that's like saying that Julius Caesar and Alexander have their parallels. That's because Julius Caesar spent a part of his career trying to be the new Alexander. So maybe there's some connection there. Yeah. I find it can be entertaining, but it does kind of set me on edge a little bit. I think it's that impulse of typology that you see. The Romans were very fond of that, of course, of saying, Augustus is the new Romulus or whatever. But it's a biblical exegesis process. It's like, who's the new Old Testament prophet in the New Testament? That's fine for a text. I don't think it works in real life.
Yeah, that's not actually how the history of humanity is unfolding itself. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for sharing some time with us. And I want to just reiterate, okay, it's the storm before the storm. And I think this episode will probably be out after it has already become available. So everyone, go get the book. It's available. And you're going to be, because I think it'll come out in the beginning of November. Will you still be on your tour then? You'll be on the book tour?
I will be, but if it comes out in early November, by the time you are listening to this, I will have come and gone from the East Coast,
right?
Where I did some stuff in New York and Boston and Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. I will be at the Wisconsin Book Festival on November 4th. I will have a thing in Chicago on November 16th. There's going to be a Milwaukee date in there that I can't remember off the top of my head. But really, if you're looking for the future and you happen to be on the West Coast, the first week of December 2017, I'll be in LA, then San Francisco, then Portland, and then Seattle.
You looking forward to it?
I'm very much looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to the tours in general.
Yeah, that's what I
mean. But, you know, that West Coast swing, you know, I'm from Seattle originally. And, well, the history of Rome started in Portland.
Right, right.
I have an event at Powell's in Portland, which is like, I mean, that's like the homecoming of all homecomings because most of my original Roman history library was like bought in that store.
Right.
10 or 12 years ago. So it's really cool to now get to come back and like have a book on their shelves. Like it's crazy.
And it of course gives you an opportunity. I guess when you used to do the history of Rome tours and the revolutions tours, you got a chance to meet actual people who listen to the podcast, which is I think something that a lot of podcasters never really do. but you'll get to meet a whole bunch of them now.
I will get to meet a whole bunch of them. And, you know, the thing, maybe we can end on this, but like one of the things that I'm almost like most proud of about all the shows that I've put out, like what's the thing that's proud of? Like the secret first answer is that the people who listen to the show, when I meet them, they're like uniformly like intelligent, funny, nice, kind people. So like whatever sort of the show is, like whatever the kind of person it happens to attract, are that way. They're like uniformly lovely, nice, funny people. So like whatever it is that I'm doing,
you're doing something right.
It's attracting. I don't know what it is, but I've never not been just utterly delighted to meet listeners of the show.
Well, that's great. And I'm unfortunately being up in the wilds of Northern Ontario, we're not going to be able to manage to get down to any of your dates, but I look forward to the Twitter reports on the events.
Right. Well, yeah, my Twitter feed is about to turn into a nonstop publicity fest. everything up until now has been merely in the service of having tricked a couple 10,000, 15,000 people into following me, so that when the book comes out, they will just be subjected to endless publicity.
Very, a long game, but a good game.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You gotta play long con.
Well, have a fabulous time, and I very much look forward to the book and it being out. And I may have to read it and listen to the audiobook because I'm not sure that I can quite handle just reading your words. Yeah. Not hearing you.
Gotta hear it. Hear your voice.
It's. I've gotten that plenty. I did record the audiobook, so it will be me.
You do have the perfect podcast voice, I must say.
Thank you.
So thank you very much, and have a great time on the tour.
Thank you.
For more information on this podcast, check out our website, www.alliterative.net, where you can find links to the videos, blog posts, sources, and credits, and all our contact info.
And please check out our Patreon, where you can pledge to support this show and our video project. You can go directly to the videos at youtube.com/alliterative.
Our email is on the website, but the easiest way to get in touch with us is Twitter. I'm at AvenSarah, AvenSarah.
And I'm at alliterative. To keep up with the podcast, subscribe on your favorite podcast app or to the feed on the website.
And if you've enjoyed it, consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It helps us a lot. We'll be back soon with more musings about the connections around us. Thanks for listening.
Bye.